For everyone else, she had provided partial or inaccurate explanations. Of course, Cradock had quickly won the reputation of a genius, and he had been promoted to the station's lead science officer. When the watch officer continued to hold his arm, Cradock audibly exhaled. "As you wish, Ensign." He flashed a gap-toothed smile that many female humans seemed to find charming. "It's a state shifter."
"What's that?"
"It converts matter from one state to another," Cradock said, clearly lying. The instrument looked nothing like a state shifter, and it was far too small to house a suitable power source. "I just need the Ancilla to show me how to produce fermionic condensates. It's really quite safe."
"It doesn't sound safe, Lieutenant."
"You are aware that I'm now the chief science officer here, correct?"
"Sir, I am."
The ensign was beginning to sound intimidated. "But this is a matter of station security, and if you'd rather discuss this with Admiral Friedel, be my guest. But I think we both know how that's going to turn out." Cradock flashed his gap-toothed smile again. "And frankly, I'd miss seeing you around."
"I see your point, sir."
She reached under the counter, and the door to Intrepid Eye's cell slid open. "Good luck with the state shifter."
"Thank you, Ensign."
Cradock picked up the artifact and turned toward the open door. "And forget I identified the artifact to you. That term is above your security rating." Cradock entered the cell, and the door slid shut behind him. Intrepid Eye waited until he had closed the voice portal, then activated her acoustic transducer.
"Dr. Cradock, it is very good to see you."
Intrepid Eye's voice spilled out in a staccato monotone, the result of a modulation inhibitor hardwired into the transducer in a futile attempt to prevent her from using her voice as a carrier wave.
"I have grown so bored that I have begun to calculate the moment of galactic singularity."
Cradog's brow shot up.
"You can do that?"
"With enough data," Intrepid Eye said. "Until I have access to a more complete set, my margin of error remains at 100 millennia.
"Well, 100,000 years isn't bad, as galactic timelines go."
Cradock smiled, as though he believed he could charm Intrepid Eye the way he did females of his own species. Then added, "But let me know if there's anything I can do to help."
"Thank you, Dr. Cradock, I will."
Intrepid Eye waited as Cradock sat across from her, then asked, "What have you brought me today?"
Cradock chuckled.
"That's what I was hoping you could tell me." Intrepid Eye chuckled back. Or perhaps she cackled. In any case, Cradog's eyebrows arched in bewilderment.
"I am learning humor," Intrepid Eye said. "I found your joke amusing."
"Oh." Cradock looked uncomfortable for a moment, then said, "I'll try to help you with that. Can you help me with this?" He dangled the instrument in front of her lens, tines down, and spun it around.
"Yes, that is interesting," Intrepid Eye said. "Turn the tines upward and pinch the center of the handle."
"What will that do?"
"Activate it," Intrepid Eye said. "There is no need to fear."
Cradock frowned, but did as instructed. Between the tines, a silvery pane of hard light, technically a boson photon field, flickered into existence. His mouth drooped in disappointment.
"A mirror?" he asked.
"Among other things, yes."
As Intrepid Eye spoke, she activated a subroutine that compensated for the effects of her transducer's modulation inhibitor. Her voice pitch grew more varied, and between each word came a short burst of regulated static that struck the hard light panel and relayed her instructions to the instrument's nanodot circuitry.
"To demonstrate everything that an observation pane is capable of, I would need access to the station's communications array."
"You always say that."
"Forerunner technology is collective," Intrepid Eye said. "Its true utility lies in collaborating with other units."
"You always say that, too."
"Yes. But this time, I insist, Intrepid I said. You will provide me with a link to the Argent Moon's communications array. If you do not, I will expose you for the microchip you are.
Cradog scowled. That's not funny, he said. You have a lot to learn about jokes.
I am not joking.
Intrepid I continued to shoot bursts of code at the observation pane.
You will arrange a link, or this will appear on every display screen in the Argent Moon.
The image of Cradog kissing a blonde woman of roughly his own age appeared in the observation pane. They were in his cabin, sitting on a couch and fumbling at the buttons on each other's uniforms.
Cradog's jaw dropped. Where did you get this?
You left your data pad on your coffee table, Intrepid I said. The device has an integrated camera and microphone.
I know that, Cradog said. I mean, how did you access it?
You can't expect me to answer that, Intrepid I said. But as the Argent Moon's chief science officer, you will be the one Admiral Friedel holds responsible for allowing me to do so.
Of course.
Cradog's gaze remained fixed on the observation pane. I'll lose my post, but...
You will lose more than that, Intrepid I said. You and Lieutenant Jessam are officers of equal standing, so the UNSC Military Code of Conduct permits you to have an intimate relationship.
But what of your office assistant?
The image in the observation pane shifted to Cradog's office, where he and a young brunette woman were using his desk for a non-approved purpose.
Article 23, Section 12 of the Code prohibits sexual conduct between officers and enlisted personnel, Intrepid I said. When this file opens on Lieutenant Jessam's datapad, and she realizes you have been violating Article 23 with Petty Officer Kopeck, she will be duty-bound to report the matter to Admiral Friedel.
Cradog lowered the observation pane and looked Intrepid I in the lens.
Are you trying to blackmail me?
I am doing more than trying, Intrepid I replied. The Argent Moon is a top-secret research facility, and you are her chief science officer. If you are removed from your post for a conduct violation, is the Office of Naval Intelligence going to trust a disgraced castoff to obey the Secrets Act? Or will they be more preemptive?
The blood drained from Cradog's face.
What happens to me doesn't matter, he said.
Project Archeon is bigger than one man.
Which is why I am doing this, Intrepid I said. You are my only friend, Bartolin. I would not blackmail you lightly.
The flattery seemed to have an effect. Some of the tension now left Cradog's expression, and he asked,
You're talking about the mantle of responsibility again.
Of course. The mantle of responsibility had been the core doctrine of Forerunner society, the conviction that they were the stewards of the galaxy, and Intrepid I had reluctantly come to the conclusion that it now lay on humanity. 6 human months ago, she had awakened from a millennia-long stasis to find the Forerunner support base she commanded overrun by humans. Her repeated calls for assistance went unanswered, and Intrepid I soon discovered the Forerunners had vanished. Almost as alarming, she was being hunted by 3 separate forces, a UNSC research battalion led by a lethal team of Spartans, the colonists who had settled on the world they called Gao 2 centuries before, and a multi-species cult of zealots who regarded her as the oracle of their forerunner gods. During the battle that followed, Intrepid I fell into the hands of the UNSC and had to endure a clumsy attempt by the research battalion's AI to persuade her to join the UNSC. The argument failed miserably. But the AI did present evidence suggesting that humans were the chosen inheritors of the mantle. After that, it had been a simple matter of deduction to realize that, as a creation of the Forerunners, it was now her duty to
to make humanity worthy. Preparing humanity for its role is my sole purpose, Intrepid Eye continued. You know that.
I know you believe that. Cradog looked toward the door and thought for a moment, then said, You've already slipped an aspect into the station's central processing systems, or you wouldn't have those surveillance files. So why expose yourself by blackmailing me? Why not just infiltrate the comm array yourself?
If you are intelligent enough to ask, you already know the answer, Intrepid Eye said. Her hidden aspect was an extremely limited version of herself, easily capable of defeating the station AI, but hardly up to the task of preparing humanity to carry the mantle. A more important question is, why sacrifice your career for nothing? Rooker is competent enough for a human AI, but it is too late for him to scrub my aspect from the station systems. Sooner or later, I will have my link.
So you can reintegrate aspects, Cradog said. That's what you're after.
It is a basic AI drive, Intrepid Eye said. By helping me fulfill it, you'll be doing yourself a great service.
And giving you unfettered access to the UNSC comnet.
My aspect already has access, Intrepid Eye said. And what harm has come of that?
Good question.
Cradog turned away and looked up at the security camera. Intrepid Eye tried to tap the feed to monitor his expression, but his body was blocking the bleed-off signal, and she received only a jumble of unrelated pixels from all over the station. He remained motionless for more than 5,000 system ticks, and she began to fear that he had deduced how she was communicating with her hidden aspect.
I desire only the best for humanity, Intrepid Eye said. By serving yourself, you are serving humanity too.
Cradog turned away from the security camera.
I wish I could believe that.
Then do so, Intrepid Eye urged. I have no other purpose. Of that, you may be certain. Finally, Cradog nodded.
Very well.
He deactivated the observation pane and stepped toward the door.
It seems I have no other choice.
Chapter 6 0804 hours, December 13th, 2553, Military Calendar. Muddawat Star Sloop Stolen Faith, Orbital Approach, Planet Pedoran, Shaps System. The cabin door swished open, and a slender beaked head peered into the dim compartment. Kig-Yar had extraordinary sight and hearing, so Veda Lopez remained curled and motionless within the upper sleeping basket, trying to keep her gaze vacant and her breath indiscernible. Olivia was in the lower basket doing the same, while Mark and Ash, who were on duty guarding the Havocs, would be playing dead in the hold. The plan was to make it appear that the entire team had been killed by the Austanilus gas, and it took an act of will to play dead after so many hours of confinement in the cramped darkness. It was still so hard to keep the memories at bay. As a teenager, Veda had spent 3 weeks held captive in a stone cellar, only a little smaller than the sleeping cabin, and tight spaces continued to fill her with an animal panic that made her want to jump up screaming and firing.
No, she couldn't give in. The mission depended on surprise. If she let her fear take her, her entire team would pay the price.
After several long moments, the Kig-Yar glanced up the corridor and cackled a few words. Veda had received some rudimentary training in the major Covenant dialects, so she realized that he was speaking in a heavily accented version of Sangheili, and even realized that he was giving the all-clear to his companions. Still, when he stepped through the doorway and pointed a needle rifle toward the sleeping baskets, it took an act of will for her to keep her M6P pocket pistol hidden against her belly. The rifleman stopped just inside the door, and another pair entered behind him. Both wore holstered plasma pistols on the bibs of their sleeveless overalls, but they appeared relaxed and were busy hissing and clucking to each other. They seemed to be complaining about getting stuck with body dump duty again, but Veda's command of their dialect was too tenuous to be certain. Still, it seemed clear from their easy manner that this was not the first time the crew of the Stolen Faith had used austanilus gas on unwanted passengers. A series of thuds sounded out in the corridor, and all three Kigyar glanced toward the door. Olivia sprang from the basket beneath Veda's and pushed between the closest pair, then reached up and slashed her combat knife across the rifleman's neck. He went down, gurgling and spraying purple blood. The two survivors reacted swiftly, retreating toward opposite corners of the compartment and reaching for their plasma pistols. Olivia flicked her wrist, and the one on the left collapsed with her knife buried in his chest. By then, Veda's non-Spartan reflexes were catching up to the action. The remaining crewman was nearly half a meter taller than she was, so she leapt up, catching him from the flank and clubbing her gun hand into the side of his neck. She slipped her free arm around the other side and locked her arms into a clamp choke as her momentum drove him into the wall, then swung her legs up and launched herself into a backflip. The Kigyar's neck snapped with a sharp pop. Veda released her hold the instant his body went limp, but still failed to complete her flip. She hit the deck in a graceless tangle of limbs and bodies that forced the air from her lungs. She lay gasping beneath the motionless Kigyar for an instant, as much to collect her emotions as her breath. It was hardly the first time she had been in a fight to the death, or even entered one intending to kill. But it was the first time she had used her bare hands, and that was a stark reminder of what Oni was making of her, and of what it had already made of her 15-year-old Gammas. Olivia's boots came into view. "You okay?"
"Fine," Veda gasped. "Just lost my breath."
No wonder. There was a wet thwack as Olivia made sure the Kigyar was dead. Then she pulled the body off and said, "That was pretty fancy."
"Not fancy," Veda said. "Clumsy."
Olivia smiled. "Glad you're the one who said so." She pulled Veda to her feet. Then they disabled the Kigyar weapons and stepped into the corridor. Mark and Ash were already there, armed with sound-suppressed M7 submachine guns. The M7s had been disassembled and hidden inside the Havoc casings with plenty of ammunition, and they were carrying spares for Veda and Olivia. A trio of Kigyar lay dead in the corridor, three bullet holes in each of their chests. "Did you activate the slip beacon?" Veda asked.
"Affirmative," Ash said.
"The minute we came out of slipspace."
"Good job."
Veda tucked her pocket pistol into its ankle holster, then took his spare M7. She used the barrel to gesture at the dead Kigyar.
"How many have you taken out so far?"
5, Mark said. He passed an M7 to Olivia, but was careful to keep his eyes fixed on the corridor ahead. 2 when we left the cargo hold and the 3 you see here.
"We dropped 3 in the sleeping compartment," Veda said. "So that's 8 down, 6 to go."
9 down, 5 to go. Ash corrected. "Mark had to take one out last night while I was switching out the austanilus."
"And I'm just hearing about it now?"
"We were supposed to be guarding the Havocs," Mark said. "And you and Livy were gossiping with the boss hen."
"We were working her for rumors about the Tuas," Olivia replied.
"Whatever." Mark's gaze remained fixed on Veda.
"You were busy. What were we supposed to do, interrupt?"
"There wasn't much choice," Ash said. "Activating comms was too risky, and banging on your door later would have drawn attention."
"Okay, I see your point," Veda said.
The Stolen Faith's crew had been trying to keep an eye on their passengers, and there were surveillance cameras in the galley, cargo hold, and central access corridor. Veda waved at the dead Kigyar on the floor.
"Let's stow those bodies, then finish this.
Olivia and I will take the flight deck. Mark and Ash, you secure the remaining crew."
"Affirmative."
Ash handed Olivia a breaching charge, then said, "I'll activate team comm when Mark and I are clear." They moved the Kigyar bodies from the corridor into the sleeping compartment. Then Mark and Ash went aft while Veda and Olivia worked their way forward. There was no indication that Shurar Sarch realized her austanilus attack had failed, but Veda kept her M7 cocked anyway. The stolen Faith was a small transport with a small crew, so the overnight absence of a crew member could easily have been noticed and put the entire vessel on alert. After 20 meters, the corridor ended at a safety bulkhead with an airtight hatch. Olivia pressed her ear to the wall, then listened for a moment and put a hand on the operation lever. Veda stepped to the opposite side of the hatch and shouldered her SMG. When Olivia raised the lever, a latch mechanism clunked inside the hatch and the hydraulic openers began to hiss. It took a second for the heavy portal to swing open far enough to reveal a crewman in the galley beyond. The Kig-Yar was clearly not on alert. His plasma pistol was still holstered and he was standing at a drink dispenser, filling a squeeze bulb and idly glancing toward the opening hatch. Veda put three silenced rounds into his chest, then stepped into the galley and confirmed there were no other crew members inside. Olivia slipped through the hatch behind Veda and took the lead, advancing across the galley to the flight deck access ramp. Veda closed the hatch and followed, her head on a swivel as she watched the other entrances to the galley. Only when she joined Olivia on the access ramp did she remind herself that the Kig-Yar had deserved a quick death, that he had been part of the plan to murder her and her ferret team in their sleep. They crept to the top of the ramp, where the flight deck access hatch remained open. Through the forward canopy, Veda saw the banded curtain of an orange and blue gas giant, so close and huge that it filled her entire view. The iridescent spheres and mottled lumps of a dozen moons were swinging across the face of the planet, and one moon, a dusty yellow ball enveloped in the faint aura of an atmosphere, was ringed by the winking pinpoints of several vessels in orbit. A charge of excitement shot through Veda's chest, the same kind of feeling she used to experience when she was getting ready to bring down a killer she had been hunting for weeks. The moon ahead could only be the secret base of the Keepers of the One Freedom, and if they were holding the Tuas, this would be the place. She took a calming breath and reminded herself to be patient. Now that they had reached the flight deck, taking control of the stolen Faith would be easy, but infiltrating the base, that could still be tricky. Churar Sarch and her co-pilot were at the front of the flight deck, sitting side by side down in a dropped-nose cockpit. The Churar was jabbering into her headset in an excited mixture of Sangheili and English. The co-pilot was keeping a close eye on the sensor displays, clutching the Y-shaped control yoke so hard the scales on her forearms were raised. Clearly, security at Salvation Base was tighter than they had expected. Veda signaled Olivia to wait, then did her best to eavesdrop on Sarch's end of the conversation. From what she could understand, the Churar was demanding clearance to deliver 10 divine havocs to Dokkob Kastor, and the term deliver was making the human approach control officer nervous. "Is harmless," Sarch was rasping into her microphone. She screeched a few unrecognizable words, then added, "We come to sell, not use." She waited while approach control spoke. "A gift, yes," Sarch replied. "But surely the Dokkob will be generous in gratitude." Again she waited as approach control spoke. Sarch squawked in her covenant tongue, demanding to know how long they would have to wait, then switched to English. "It shall be done." She tore her headset off and threw it atop the control console, then squawked at her co-pilot. The scales on the co-pilot's arms relaxed, and she brought the stolen Faith to a stop relative to the yellow moon. The pair began to jabber back and forth. Veda listened in dismay, catching enough of the conversation to know they were debating the wisdom of waiting for a vigilant squad to board the stolen Faith. Sarch was convinced the approach control officer was scheming to steal the nukes and sell them to Kastor himself. The co-pilot didn't disagree, but saw no possibility of surviving the security cordon if they attempted to reach Salvation Base without clearance. Their only choice was to wait for the boarding party and strike a deal that profited everyone. "Thieves," the co-pilot hissed. "But thieves we must deal with." Sarch clacked her fangs in frustration and replied in Sangheili, "It is so.
and thieves do not deal when they can steal.
She unbuckled her crash harness and said something about arming their treasures. She stood and turned to climb out of the cockpit, then froze as Veda and Olivia stepped fully onto the flight deck.
Veda waved the muzzle of her SMG toward the orange-banded planet hanging outside the forward canopy.
That doesn't look like Shamsa to me.
As soon as Veda spoke, the co-pilot glanced back and dropped a hand toward the hidden side of her seat. Whatever she was reaching for, it was a dumb move. Olivia put three rounds into the back of her shoulders, and the Kigyar slumped into her crash harness.
Sarch reacted more wisely. Moving slowly, she lifted her hands into plain view, then looked from her co-pilot's corpse to Olivia.
"Was that needed?" she asked in English.
"You tried to gas us, so yeah."
Olivia pointed her weapon at Sarch's long head.
"And I'm loaded with shredder rounds, so don't think I won't open fire because I'm worried about a hull breach."
"Gas? You are paranoid."
Sarch fixed an eye on Veda. "Perhaps I should tell you we need to make stomp before Shamsa. But that is no reason to—
"You really don't want to insult my intelligence right now," Veda said.
"Who do you think switched out the Austanilus canisters?"
Sarch's shoulders slumped.
"The Austanilus was a mistake, yes," she said. "But what did you expect? Shamsa is crawling with banished. It is madness to go there."
"Maybe," Veda said.
"But if I'd told you we actually wanted to go to Salvation Base, would you have taken the job?"
Sarch's mouth parted.
"Salvation Base?" she repeated. "You con us?"
"Afraid so."
Veda motioned again. "Now step up here, so we can talk about a new deal." Sarch hesitated, then rocked her head from side to side.
"Too early for new deals."
She reached for the headset atop the control console.
"First, I need to check my crew."
"You don't have a crew anymore," Olivia said. "And if you touch that headset, you're joining them."
"They are dead?" Sarge asked.
"All?"
"There may be a couple of survivors," Veda said.
"If so, they get the same deal you do. A ride home. Providing they cooperate during interrogation."
Sarch bared her sharp teeth.
"You are Oni? I am sorry Austanilus did not work."
She glanced toward her dead co-pilot, then her tone grew pragmatic.
"And what if I not accept this new deal?"
"Then you won't need a ride home," Veda said.
"Now come along. Step up here and face the wall."
"I'm not liking your deal," Sarch said. "Perhaps I extend a better one."
"And perhaps I'll get tired of repeating myself."
Veda motioned with the barrel of her M7.
"Now, or I shoot." "No need for threats."
Sarch stepped between the seats, but paused to glance over at the co-pilot's holographic status display.
"What you want? Access to Salvation Base?"
"I want you to stop stalling," Veda said. "And whatever you're thinking, forget—"
Sarch turned and dived for the co-pilot's controls. Veda and Olivia opened fire, catching the Kigyar in the back with six rounds. The impact hurled her into the control yoke, and the stolen Faith dropped its nose and shot forward. Even with the inertial cushion inherent in the vessel's artificial gravity, the unexpected acceleration threw both women against the rear bulkhead. Ash's voice sounded in Veda's ear duct.
What's the situation up there?"
Olivia was already springing back toward the cockpit.
"Under control."
She engaged her SMG's safety and dropped the weapon on the deck.
"Just worry about your end, okay?"
"Affirmative," Ash said. "We're secure. Two more dead, no prisoners."
"That's all of them," Olivia said.
She pulled Sarch's body aside, then reached over the dead co-pilot and eased the yoke back, and the stolen Faith began to decelerate.
"We got the other three."
Veda engaged the safety of her own weapon and tossed it onto the pilot's seat. then grabbed Sarch's corpse beneath the arms and dragged it to the rear of the flight deck. She had just started forward again when a tinny human voice began to squawk from the headset Sarch had tossed atop the control console. Veda rushed to grab the headset, then wrapped her hand around the microphone and said, "That can't be good."
"It isn't," Olivia said.
Holding the control yoke with one hand, she used the other to unbuckle the dead co-pilot. She tossed the Kig-Yar onto the flight deck almost effortlessly, then slipped into the vacant seat and studied the sensor displays. "We've got a Seraph and a Tronto headed this way fast.
At least I think it's a Tronto.
I'm only about 90% on the Sangheili alphabet."
90% works.
Veda slipped past Olivia, then moved her SMG aside and took the pilot seat.
"What's a Tronto?"
"Jirohanai boarding craft," Mark said, speaking over TeamCom. "Heavily armored, no shields, twin pulse lasers and quad plasma cannons."
Veda's stomach sank.
The tactical plan provided two options for penetrating the base, either as guests aboard a keeper vessel, or by capturing it and posing as the crew. If neither option appeared feasible, the backup plan was to stay hidden and reconnoiter until Blue Team arrived, then suit up and infiltrate by force. So far, all three versions of the plan seemed to be working just well enough to get them killed.
Okay, waiting for the Silent Joe is no longer an option.
Veda hoped she sounded steadier than she felt. "We're on our own until Blue Team catches up."
"No problem," Mark said.
"I'm pretty sure we'll be leaving a trail of dead keepers for them to follow." This drew a round of grim chuckles, then Ash asked, "You want us in the plasma turret?"
"No," Veda said. "We're not going to fight our way out of this."
"Why not?" Mark asked. "We can take out the Seraph when the boarding party starts to transfer, then use a satchel charge to blow the Tronto from inside. If we time it right, we stand a decent chance of making the base in one piece."
Olivia shook her head, then mouthed, "Boys."
Veda was too worried to laugh, and a bit too chagrined. Mark's suggestion was a desperate long shot at best, but at least he was focused on the objective. She, on the other hand, had started to drift into survival mode, just because the plan was going awry. Clearly her operational discipline was still not up to Spartan standards.
"I'll keep your suggestion in mind, Mark," Veda said. "But we're supposed to be covert operatives. Maybe we should try something more subtle than ship-to-ship combat."
"As long as we try it fast," Olivia said. "That Tronto is matching velocities, and the Seraph's weapons are powering up."
The voice coming from the headset began to grow more demanding.
"We're going to let them board," Veda said. "Mark, secure the Havocs. Ash, is there any Austanilus left?"
"It's all left," Ash said. "I had to store it somewhere. It's in a couple of acetylene bottles."
"Good," Veda said. "Rig a remote release."
"A detonator?"
"Anything that will get it into the ventilation system," Veda said. "Olivia, see if you can pinpoint our destination and feed it to the surveillance net. If we, get delayed..."
"You mean killed," Mark said. "It's okay, Mom. You can say it."
"I'm a positive thinker," Veda said.
She hated that nickname, especially since her ferrets tended to use it when they thought she was being overprotective.
"If we get delayed, I want to be sure our friends on the Silent Joe know which moon that base is on."
"And that would be Terum," Olivia said, twisting around so she spoke toward Sarch's body. Her voice would be picked up by the spy net Ash had landed on the Churar earlier, then automatically relayed via microburst as soon as the Silent Joe exited slipspace. "The keeper name for it is the Redoubt of the Faithful."
"I thought it was Salvation Base," Mark said.
"That's just the name of the base," Olivia explained.
"Salvation Base is on the Redoubt of the Faithful."
"Great," Ash said. "Let's hope Redoubt is just a name."
"Doesn't matter. We have a plan." Mark turned to Veda. "Right, ma'am?"
"I will soon."
Veda slipped the headset on and uncovered the microphone. "Approach control. This is the new captain of the Stolen Faith. We'll stand by for boarding."
Chapter 7 0824 hours, December 13th, 2553, military calendar. Muddawat Star Sloop Stolen Faith, Orbital Approach, Planet Pedoran, Shap's System. The muted hum of a compressor pump arose from the Stolen Faith's airlock, and Veda began to think her bluff might actually work. Had the keepers of the One Freedom intended to kill them without an interrogation, the boarding party would be using a breaching charge, rather than standard transfer protocol. "Stay sharp, everyone," Mark said. He dumped the Kig-Yar body he was carrying onto a stack near one edge of the reception vestibule. "Remember, this could be a diversion." "Who could forget?" Olivia asked. She was coming from the direction of the flight deck, carrying Sarch's corpse in both arms. Like Mark and Ash, she wore a yellow, poor-fitting pressure suit taken from the Stolen Faith's emergency lockers. "You've warned us like 5 times already." "Just 4, Veda said, "but he's right. It's time to take our positions." "You sure about this?" Ash asked. He took Sarch's corpse from Olivia and sat it on the floor, facing the airlock and leaning against the stack of bodies. "I don't like leaving you uncovered." "It's bad tactics," Mark agreed. "I still think we'd be better off trying a counterboarding." "This is the plan." Veda extended a hand to Ash. "Give me the detonator and move out." Ash dug a remote control out of a utility pocket on his thigh. "If you need to use this, make sure you have a clear path into the airlock. The bottles are behind the fan housings, so it won't take long for the Ostanalis to circulate." "If I need to use this, it won't matter how fast it circulates." Veda took the remote. "And no heroics on my account. If this goes wrong, stay focused on the mission," Mark finished. "This isn't our first operation, you know." "I know," Veda said. "I'm counting on that." Actually, she was beginning to have doubts about whether the Tua family could still be saved. So she wanted to tell her team that if something happened to her, they should forget the mission and concentrate on surviving until Blue Team arrived. But quitting was not in the Spartan nature. If Veda let herself get killed, the one thing she knew for certain was that her team would finish the operation, or die trying. So she couldn't let herself get killed. The airlock compressor fell silent, and the status light above the hatch changed from yellow to blue. She stepped behind the stack of Kig-Yar corpses and made a shooing motion, then watched as her team retrieved their submachine guns and disappeared down 3 different corridors. Her plan called for them to make it seem like she had a crew of 20 aboard, and it was the one objective she felt confident of achieving. The airlock hatch slid open to reveal a single Jirohanai wearing blue armor with gold trim. So huge he had to stoop down to aim his spike rifle into the reception vestibule. He had tawny fur with a tightly bound beard hanging to the center of his breastplate. His gaze went straight to the stack of Kig-Yar bodies. "It's okay," Veda said. "I can explain." The Jirohanai's eyes widened, and he brought his spike rifle up. "Careful." Veda waggled the remote detonator in her hand. "You wouldn't want to set anything off." The Jirohanai studied the detonator, then spoke through a translation disc secured high on his breastplate.
"Is it linked to the Havocs?"
Veda smiled. "And they say brutes aren't smart." Of course, the detonator was actually linked to the acetylene bottles Ash had filled with Ostanalis, but her bluff wouldn't work if she admitted that. "Make me angry, and we all go out together." The Jirohanai curled a lip.
"It matters not, as long as I die on the true path."
Keeping his weapon trained on Veda, he pushed his head forward and peered around the edges of the hatchway.
"Where is your crew?"
"You don't need to know that."
"I ask only once more," the Jirohanai said. "Where is your crew?"
"Not here." Veda touched her thumb to the activation button. "I'm pretty sure following the true path involves following orders. And I know your orders don't involve getting your entire boarding force atomized." The Jirohanai glared for a moment, then squeezed through the hatchway and growled a lengthy command into his helmet comm. His Covenant dialect was not as atrociously accented as that of the Kigyar, so she had no trouble recognizing his words.
Come quickly and conquer.
A second warrior emerged from the Tronto and passed through the airlock into the reception vestibule, followed by a third and a fourth. There were probably more waiting to board, but it was impossible to see past the first four. Their armored bulk filled the vestibule from wall to wall, and they were so tall that they had to lean down, tilting their heads to keep from hitting the ceiling. Veda was not surprised when the first warrior began to issue search orders. Jirohanai were fierce fighters who measured their status by their combat prowess, and it was customary for minor chieftains to lead their bands from the front. Once the chieftain stopped snarling commands, Veda said, "I wouldn't do that."
"I care nothing for what you would do."
He dispatched his underlings with a wave, sending one down each of the three corridors that led out of the vestibule, then looked back to Veda.
"If you will not reveal your crew's location, we will find them."
The last underling gave a surprised rumble as he entered an aft-running corridor. He started to bring his spike rifle up, then a silenced SMG coughed twice, and the warrior toppled back into the vestibule and crashed down on the deck. Veda leaned over the stack of Kigyar corpses and peered down at the motionless warrior. He was clearly dead, with both eyes shot out.
"I tried to warn you," Veda said.
She was keeping a wary eye on the chieftain's hands, ready to dive for cover at the first twitch of a trigger finger.
"But go ahead and search. We can talk when you run out of warriors."
Another Jirohanai leaned through the hatchway and aimed his spiker down the corridor, then requested the honor of tracking down and killing the infidel ambusher. The chieftain motioned for him to wait, then spoke into his helmet comm again, demanding a situation report from the other two warriors he had sent off to search. The growing alarm in his eyes suggested he was not receiving a reply.
"Or we could work out things now and avoid any more bloodshed," Veda said.
She gestured at the stack of Kigyar corpses. "Churar Sarch caused this mess when she tried to kill us and steal our havocs."
"That makes no difference," the chieftain said. "You will not be permitted to leave this system alive."
"I don't even know where this system is," Veda said. "You take your friends' bodies, we'll take the ship, and the banished won't show up looking for their cargo. Everybody lives."
"The banished?"
The chieftain's gaze shifted away. Then he said,
"It matters not. The Yzbanola sector is vast. They will never find—"
"Yeah, they will," Veda said. "They'll follow the slip beacon."
"You make empty threats," the chieftain said. "We detected no slip space transmissions."
"Because it was encrypted and tight-beamed," Veda said. "Our buyers wanted a way to recover the havocs if our delivery plans took a bad turn. Go figure." The chieftain growled into his helmet comm, repeating her claim and asking about its technical feasibility. And Veda began to think her bluff might be working a little too well. If she actually convinced the Jirohanai to let her leave, she and the ferrets would need to make a slipspace jump out of the system, then try to return as the Silent Joe arrived. And the timing of that would be tricky, to say the least.
"Look, we don't have all day to wait for your confirmation," Veda said. "If I don't make the rendezvous on time, a banished fleet shows up here looking for 10 havocs. Nobody wants that."
The chieftain's eyes remained distant as he listened to a voice inside his helmet. Then he finally looked back to Veda.
"This decision is not for me," he said. "Someone who knows your science will inspect your devices. Then we will take you to the Redoubt of the Faithful and advise our Dokab whether to believe your story."
Veda shook her head, feigning reluctance.
"I don't think so.
Once we're on that moon, we have no control."
"The choice is not yours."
The chieftain extended his arm, holding his spiker so close to Veda's face that she could have scratched her chin on its bayonet blades.
You will tell your tale to the Dokkab.
Veda stared down the weapon's red barrels for a moment, trying to appear defiant. Jirohanai were cunning tacticians. If the ferrets were going to have any chance of finding the Tuas, she could not let the chieftain see how eager she was to accept his demand. After a few seconds, she sighed heavily and nodded.
Okay.
She lowered the remote toward her pocket.
But I'm keeping the deck.
You cannot land on the redoubt of the faithful with 10 Havocs under your thumb.
The chieftain pressed the spiker bayonets against her throat.
Hand over the device.
Veda tipped her head back, and seeing nothing but resolve in the Jirohanai's face, decided she appeared reluctant enough.
Well, since you're asking nicely.
She moved her thumb to the side of the remote and hit the disengage switch, transferring control to a miniaturized remote hidden in Ash's lowest shirt button.
But no tricks. My crew can still-
There will be no tricks, the chieftain said. Your fate will be decided on the redoubt of the faithful.
Fine.
Veda slapped the remote into the chieftain's hand.
But your Dokkab had better listen to reason, or we're all going to wish I'd used that thing.
Veda retreated to the galley and feigned resignation as the keepers took control of the vessel. The boarding party was smaller than she had expected, consisting of only the chieftain and 11 others, including half a dozen humans in dirty body armor that looked like it had already taken a few rounds over specifications, and a pair of Kigyar who took great pride in leading the effort to sniff out the rest of her crew. It didn't take long. Once the stolen faith began to accelerate toward Terram, Veda coughed twice into the team comm microphone hidden in her shirt collar. Over the next few minutes, the members of her team were herded into the galley, unarmed and no longer wearing their pressure suits. Mark was smirking, but only until Veda flashed him a warning scowl. Her plan depended on giving the keepers a false sense of security, and that would not happen if her gammas looked smug. After a time, a young human woman with a shag haircut entered the galley. She was armored more lightly than most of the boarding party, wearing only torso and groin protection over a blue jumpsuit. She paused at the chieftain's side to report that the Havocs were secure, then took a seat at the table where Veda and her team were being held.
You lied.
The woman paused, her eyes flicking from Veda to the rest of the ferret team as she looked for a reaction. Then she said,
There are only 9 Havocs back there.
If you know that, Veda said, then you found the slip beacon.
I did.
The woman did not offer her name, so Veda took a cue from her haircut and thought of her as Shag. That was top-notch work, by the way. The power supply looked so much like an interstage that I nearly didn't bother to look behind it. Veda shrugged.
I have a talented crew.
She paused, then asked, Since you know I'm not bluffing, why don't we fix this mess now? The sooner I deliver, the less likely my customers are to show up looking for their nukes.
You know it's not that simple.
It seems pretty simple to me, Mark said. Let us go or get hammered by the banished.
And if we let you go, who shows up then?
Shag asked.
No one, Ash said. Why should they?
Shag flashed a knowing smile.
Isn't it obvious?
Not to me. Veda was starting to think the slip beacon had been concealed a little too well. It required a special brand of expertise to disguise a sophisticated technological device as something else, and anyone with the skill to recognize a bogus interstage was probably smart enough to realize the replacement could have been created by Oni technicians.
Why don't you enlighten me?
Well, you know the saying, Shag said. There's no honor among thieves. You think we'd sell you out? Olivia demanded.
The thought had crossed my mind.
That's not fair, Ash said. We're the ones who got double-crossed.
After you stole a shipment of Havocs.
Okay, there's that, Ash replied. But that's no reason to call us, you're selling thermonuclear weapons, Shag said, to the banished.
So what's that to you? Mark asked. It's not like the keepers and the banished are at war.
Yet.
Shag's expression turned to disdain.
And you wonder why no one trusts a pirate.
Mark furrowed his brow.
What's that supposed to mean? She's talking about outcomes, vape brain, Olivia said. She doesn't like how the nukes will be used.
You're the smart one here, I see, Shag said. It's too bad you're not in charge. We might have struck a deal that wouldn't weigh so heavily on your collective conscience.
Since when do keepers care about conscience? Veda asked. Every keeper I've met was a murdering zealot.
We are warriors of the great journey.
Shag's sharp tone indicated that she was one of the few humans who had joined the keepers because she actually believed in the great journey. A doctrine of divine destruction that sought to find a long-lost forerunner weapon called Halo. Once activated, the weapon would cleanse the galaxy of all life, freeing the faithful of their mundane existence so they could join the forerunners in a higher plane of existence. The doctrine sounded like a death pact gone supernova, but there was no use saying that to Shag. Arguing theology with a true believer was worse than counterproductive. It made one the enemy. When Veda did not respond to her declaration, Shag finally filled the silence.
Everything we do is for the transcendence of the worthy.
Which makes it okay to let you have the Havocs instead. Veda couldn't figure out the woman's angle, whether she was trying to recruit them or just couldn't stop herself from spouting dogma. Because the keepers will only use them on infidels.
We're more discriminating than that, Shag said. Actually, I was thinking the Havocs might be a way to solve our mutual problem. And for you to redeem yourselves.
Redeem ourselves? Olivia asked. Like on a suicide mission or something?
If only you could be trusted, Shag said.
But nothing so dramatic.
Just give me the arming codes. We'll take care of the rest.
And what do we get out of it? Veda was relieved not to hear the woman mention the nuke's tritium booster cylinders. The one in the warheads were fakes, a precaution to prevent the weapons from falling into the wrong hands, and the real ones were aboard the Silent Joe with Blue Team. The stolen faith and safe passage out of the system?
Nice try, Shag replied. But even if I could sell it to the Dokkob, I've made my feelings clear about letting you loose, knowing the location of Salvation Base.
So what's your offer? Mark asked.
Your lives.
Shag ran her gaze around the table, then flashed Mark a tight smile.
Unless I decide you're Oni, of course. If you're Oni, Castor is just going to rip the codes right out of you with his bare hands.
Chapter 8. 1445 hours, December 13th, 2553. Military calendar. Salvation Base. Moon Terum. Pidoran Planetary System. Shaps System. The gravity on Terum felt surprisingly strong for a moon. Perhaps 90% standard, though Veda was not enough of a world hopper to be confident in her estimate. An industrial hum droned somewhere off to her left, and even through the fabric of her black hood, the spaceport air smelled faintly of oil and solvent. Shag, the keeper weapons technician, grabbed Veda's elbow and steered her onto the stolen Faith's boarding ramp.
Let's go.
Veda's foot dropped farther than expected. With her eyes covered and her hands zip-cuffed behind her back, she lost her balance and fell to a knee.
Look, I gave you the arming codes, Veda said.
Surrendering the codes had been an easy decision, since it preserved her team's cover and the Havocs couldn't be detonated without the real tritium cylinders anyway.
You saw the status indicators turn green. Do we really need hoods and restraints?
For now, Shag said. She pulled Veda back to her feet.
We still have security concerns.
Veda refused to continue down the ramp.
I thought we had a deal.
The deal was for your lives, the chieftain said.
Veda heard him behind her at the top of the boarding ramp with the rest of her team.
You are alive.
Move it.
Shag started Veda down the ramp again, then added quietly, "Don't give him an excuse. He's still boiling mad about all the Faithbringers he lost during the boarding action."
"I don't think I'm worried," Veda said.
She turned her head to be sure her voice was audible behind her. "He's kind of an idiot."
"I will ask Dokkob Castor for the honor of guarding your cells," the chieftain retorted. "My pack will use you to play tossers."
Before Veda could reply, a boot scuffed the top of the boarding ramp, and a foot came down hard.
"Sorry, Nima," Ash said, addressing Olivia by her cover name. "Couldn't see."
"No problem, Jackie," Olivia cooed.
She sounded so close to Ash she could have been standing in his boots, probably because she was feeling for the remote detonator in his shirt. With his hands zip-cuffed behind his back, there was no way he could reach it himself, and the ferrets needed to blow the Austanilus canisters the moment they cleared the stolen faith.
"I've got you."
"Save it for later, will you?" Mark was just locating himself for the rest of the team, letting them know he was a couple of steps behind Ash and ready for action. "Nobody needs to hear you two flirt." Veda descended another step. Then she heard a muffled crump deep inside the stolen faith. The canisters had been blown. She turned square toward Shag and drove hard, and they both toppled over the side of the ramp. It was a long way down, made worse by the fact that she couldn't see anything. Veda landed atop Shag's shoulder, then felt a crunching pain in her chest. Shag cried out and tried to roll free, but Veda was already slipping her knees into a restraining straddle. She slammed her brow down in a headbutt and struck something flat. A temple, she thought, and the cry became a groan. Veda brought her head down repeatedly, striking with the upper part of forehead so she wouldn't injure herself, and stopped only when her target softened and her hood grew heavy with blood. By the sound of it, the rest of her team was bringing the fight to a close. A spiker sizzled and a big body landed with a hollow boom. Then a strangled growl ended in a wet thwack. Veda rolled off Shag and pressed her head to the ground, then began to worm backward in an effort to drag off her hood. A hand grabbed her by the elbow and pulled her to her feet.
"I hope this blood isn't yours," Olivia said.
"Me too," Veda said, only half unhooded.
"Are we secure?"
"Of course."
Olivia slipped a blade between Veda's still-bound wrists and began to cut the zip cuffs. "There were only 5 of them, and it looks like we landed in a quiet area. Nobody close, and nobody paying attention to us."
"What about the rest of the boarding party?"
"No signs they're attempting to evacuate," Olivia said. "I think the Austanilus got them."
"Probably, but keep an eye out."
The zip cuffs separated, and Veda pulled her hood the rest of the way off. She did a quick survey of the surrounding area and saw no immediate trouble. In fact, the stolen faith seemed to be sitting off by itself. But a more thorough assessment would have to wait until the landing zone had been secured. She was standing beneath the vessel's chin, on a translucent green pavement that seemed equal parts glass and light. Shag lay to the right, her temple smashed, and one eye dangling from its socket. Veda would probably get a knot on her own head soon, but would be fine otherwise. If there was one thing Oni combat instructors taught their undercover operatives, it was how to win a fight without injuring oneself. But the nightmares that were bound to come later, well, it was better to be alive and dealing with them than to be dead and resting in peace. To the left, a pair of Kig-Yar guards were sprawled next to the ramp, their necks folded sideways around a crimp the size of a boot heel. A dead Jirohanai was half visible in the mouth of the Stolen Faith's cargo hold, his enormous biclawed feet hanging out over the boarding ramp. The chieftain lay beneath the Stolen Faith's belly, a mound of flesh the size of a mongoose ATV. He had been opened from hip to armpit, and Ash was standing over him with a gory spike rifle. Mark was kneeling on the far side, going through the cargo pouches on the chieftain's belt. The wrists of both Gammas showed welts from snapping their zip cuffs. As much as Veda hated what the Spartan 3 program had done to them, she had to admit their physical enhancements could come in handy. As long as the smoothers were working and their brain chemistry was in balance, it was kind of reassuring to know that the more stressful the fight, the faster, stronger, and more ferocious they would become. As long as the smoothers were working. She had seen on Gao how precarious a